I'm guessing by now you've heard all about the benefits of meditation, how it can relieve stress, help you feel centered, even make you more compassionate. So if it's that beneficial, shouldn't we teach kids the art of mindfulness?
Your teachers invited me to come in here to teach you some things. So what we're going to learn about is a brand new word maybe for some people. It's called mindfulness. Can you say that?
Mindfulness.
Two important things happen with mindfulness.
This is a preschool class of 4 and 5 year olds, not far from our studio in Madison. The woman you hear is not their regular teacher. She's a certified meditation teacher.
The other thing about mindfulness is when you pay attention, what happens to your body? Get slow. So the first thing we're going to do today is pay attention on the inside. Is everybody ready? So I brought something. Who knows what that is? Will?
A bell.
We're going to listen. And when the bell stops, when you can't hear it anymore, raise your hand. Ready?
Neuroscientist Richard Davidson wants to bring the art of mindfulness into our schools. He's one of the world's leading experts on the science of mindfulness. He's teamed up with the Dalai Lama to put Buddhist monks in his brain scanning machines. And he's developing a new scientific model for studying emotion. But when Davidson was a Harvard grad student back in the 70s, cognitive science ruled, and hardly anyone thought emotions were worth studying. Richie Davidson kept pursuing his interest in the science of emotion, and as he tells Steve Paulson, his scientific work ended up changing his life.
I wanted to study emotion because I had this kind of inner conviction that emotion was really the key to so much that was important about human behavior. We inevitably resort to language that includes emotion. A person is friendly, or they're grumpy, or they're cheerful. It just struck me that emotion was key to understanding our personality.
Now, you write about something else that happened back in the 70s when you were living in the Boston area. Some of your circle of friends were involved in meditation, and that somehow seemed to hit home for you.
That was a very important influence, and these are all people who had been to India. When I first met these guys, they struck me as being extraordinarily kind, gentle, humble people, and it was their demeanor that impressed me most, not the content of what they were talking about, but just who they were as people.
So you ended up going off to India and Sri Lanka to study meditation, right, as well as to do it.
I did. I left at the end of my second year of graduate school, much to the consternation of some of the faculty at Harvard who thought that either I was going off the deep end or B, that I would never return.
What did you do over in Sri Lanka and India?
Well, in Sri Lanka, I was able to meet people who are contemplatives, who've spent their life training their mind and familiarizing themselves with their mind. Of course, the word meditation comes from the Sanskrit root, which in part means familiarization. These are people who were utterly familiar with the operation of their own mind in ways that I think are not common in the West because they've just spent so much time doing it. I then went off to India and had my first taste of intensive meditation practice. And this is kind of like meditation boot camp where we're in retreat in complete silence and meditating for, you know, more than 12 hours a day. It's very difficult to go through an experience like that and not really feel that your mind can be powerfully affected.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that your interest in the science of the mind, the science of mindfulness, has very personal roots.
It does have very personal roots. And, you know, I became involved in psychology and neuroscience because I was convinced that if people can transform their mind, we can actually make the world a better place.
Hmm. But again, it sounds like you were challenging a fundamental idea about neuroscience, which is that the mind is just what the brain does. In fact, I went to a talk not that long ago with a prominent neuroscientist, and he was asked, so what is the mind? And his definition was, the mind is what the brain does. That's not exactly your position, is it?
No, it's not exactly my position, although I still would describe myself as saying that were it not for the brain, we wouldn't have a mind. Mm-hmm. However, having said that, I also would say that we can change our brain by transforming our mind. The involvement that I've had with the meditative traditions has convinced me that we should regard qualities like kindness and compassion and equanimity and happiness and well-being, for that matter, really as the product of skills that can be nurtured through training.
But I just want to follow up on this early point because it sounds like a really radical idea that mental activity alone can change the brain, can actually change the physical structure of the brain.
I think at that time it was a radical statement, unquestionably. And the amazing thing is now I think that the majority of neuroscientists would agree with it.
No, I'm willing to bet that people who have read about you in the popular press actually know you best because of your work with the Dalai Lama and with a number of Buddhist monks. And I know this has been important to you personally. Can you take me back to the first time you met the Dalai Lama?
I met him for the first time in the fall of 1992 at his residence in Dharamsala, India. And I was in India as part of a small scientific team that he wished to encourage to investigate the minds and brains of advanced meditation practitioners who were practicing in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition. It was a very special moment. I was the spokesperson for this group of four, and when you go in to meet the Dalai Lama, you know, you have to go through certain security. He's considered a head of state. And I'm not a person who I'd consider to be very high anxious, but in the period where just after we were searched, I nearly had a panic attack, and it was because I could not envision how I was going to start the conversation. I just reflected, you know, here I was about to meet His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I was flooded with all of this self-doubt. Why am I here? Who am I to be wasting the Dalai Lama's time? And we were ushered into a room. And the Dalai Lama came in, you know, maybe 15 seconds after we were ushered into the room. And palpably, within less than 1 minute, all of my anxiety was completely and utterly and totally gone. And not only was my anxiety gone, but I felt more secure and more content than I had felt in a long, long time.
So what happened in that first minute?
You know, the Dalai Lama has an amazing presence, and he walked in, made some joke, and started laughing, and just instantaneously, he has, I think, an extraordinarily skillful way of seeing suffering in others. And he clearly, I'm sure, saw that I was very uncomfortable. And this was a way that he spontaneously and just with enormous facility completely dissipated.
Now, you've written that that first meeting with the Dalai Lama has had a tremendous impact on your life. It changed your life, both in a career sense and also in a personal sense. What happened? How did things go in a different direction after that?
Well, he at one point in the conversation really challenged me, and he said, you know, you've been using the tools of modern neuroscience to study things like fear and disgust and depression and anxiety. And he said, why can't you study kindness? Why can't you study compassion? Huh. And, you know, it was a really pivotal moment.
Had you thought about that before?
Not really. You know, it just was so outside the scientific worldview. Nobody studied kindness and compassion who was a real scientist. You know, by that time in my career, in 1992, I was a full professor and, you know, I had begun to get some awards in my career. And I felt that I would be a coward if I really didn't step up to the plate. But it wasn't, you know, the fear of being a coward that motivated me. It was really the wish to get back to my roots. And I wanted to get in this business in the first place to help people.
So that, among other things, led you to studying various Buddhist monks. I mean, experienced meditators who'd spent thousands of hours in some cases meditating to actually bring them into your lab, into your MRI machines?
Yes, it directly led to that. And so I made a commitment to His Holiness on that day that I was going to do everything I could to put compassion on the scientific and specifically the neuroscientific map, and that one of the ways that we would do it is to begin to seriously study long-term practitioners.
What's been the most important thing you've learned from those studies?
We haven't even begun to approach the limits of human neuroplasticity. It's been a humbling experience to work with these long-term practitioners to get a glimpse of the depth in which we can actually change our brain and do that through changing our mind, transforming our minds. That has been really an extraordinarily powerful opportunity to learn that.
Neuroscientist Richard Davidson runs the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin, and he's the co-author with Sharon Begley of The Emotional Life of Your Brain. You'll find Steve's extended interview with Richie Davidson, along with a complete transcript, on our website at ttbook.org/meetyourmind.